Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Bader. So lately I'm taking a lot of pictures, snapshots, but not with my, I don't have a smartphone. I have an extremely dumb phone. In fact, it's probably retarded or mentally ill. This phone doesn't, it just lays in a coma all the time in my bag. I don't even know how to answer my cell phone. The cell phone I got when I bought at Radio Shack, you know, those kind of cell phones, they're not, I don't even know what the number is. I have it for emergencies. You know, I call up somebody in case I fall down and I can't get up or whatever, you know, so I hardly ever use it. Although that doesn't stop you from losing, I don't know, it's an amazing racket. I guess there's all these deals if you have a real cell phone, right? You can work out a deal with them where you get the phone and you get a contract. But this is something I just bought for like practically no money at Radio Shack. It does work. Actually pretty well, unlike many things that one buys at Radio Shack. This phone actually works. It's a cheap piece of junk, and I've had it for about 8 years. It won't work generally if you're indoors anywhere. It just won't work. You have to go over to the window and lean out and hope you don't fall out of the window and hold it up, you know, and put your head out the window to talk. It's, you know, a crummy cell phone. But even if I don't use up the money I put in it, it tells me I've got to put more money in it all the time. So, you know, like about every month, the robot voice comes on, the pleasant lady robot voice, and says, your cell phone time is about to run out. You might die. However, you might not if you put more money in. The way to do that is, you know, that kind of thing. So, I don't know how much money goes in every month, so it's not much, like $20 or something. And I hardly ever use it. But so I have these cell phones. But I don't have a phone. My cell phone does not take pictures, and but my iPod does. I realized that about I've had an iPod for about 6 years because I was having a lot of trouble and still do have trouble reading regular print. You know, my eyes just got bad for various reasons. So I got an iPod to listen to audiobooks. And I love listening to audiobooks. I'm listening to Les Miserables by Victor Hugo now. The longest book ever written, I think. A great book. Anyhow, I discovered accidentally, just looking around at the iPod the other day, that it I only had it for 5 or 6 years, that I don't know if it doesn't take pictures, but it can actually make movies. And I'm sure everybody listening to me who has one knows that already, right? But I don't ever read directions. It doesn't matter what it is, a TV or a child's rattle that I bought for my kids when they were little. I never read a direct. I can't read directions. There's the part of my brain that can understand a direction is missing, and that's partially psychological. I cannot take orders from anybody, which is why most of my life I've either had a lot of trouble where I worked, or I worked on my own, or I was the boss, right? I have a much easier time either working on my own or being the boss. Best to work on my own because I don't like to give orders either. So there it is. I don't like to take orders and I don't like to give orders. But I don't mean like for 1 second, right? It makes me uncomfortable to tell people what to do. I will tell people what to do if I have to. It's part of my job. Or if I am in a situation where it's like an emergency or it might help them out, and I'll volunteer information or directions. But taking orders, no. Can't do that. But I have, you know, when you're a kid and you go to school and you're living in a house, or let's say if it's a relatively normal house, you know, your parents give you directions, orders. They set down rules. You go to school. You can't do this, can't do that. You can't draw outside the lines all the time, right? And, you know, on the street, you know, the lights go red, then they go green. I mean, you have to live in a civilized way in society, relatively. You have to obey rules and you have to follow orders, even if you try to avoid them. But unless you want to be a total outlaw, and we've all known them, right, or been them in our time. I learned when I got to be old enough, like I mean my 20s and 30s, that if I could find any kind of job or work that would pay me, where I didn't have to have a boss or anybody tell me what to do or tell me I was doing something wrong or suggest anything to me. So, which is why it's a good thing that I've sort of more or less made my living without too much direction and bossing for the last 20 years. It's been a good thing for me. In any case, so I find out that my iPod takes movies, and of course I can't do that really because it's a kind of a jerky little thing, and also it uses up most of the charge of the iPod, otherwise it would last for several hours. This uses it up real quick. And the other thing is that it makes me dizzy when I have vertigo. So when I'm anything that's moving or shaking or turning around while I'm moving, that's the worst possible thing. But about a year and a half ago, because I used to have cameras. I had cameras all my life. I had a little box Brownie camera. Now I go back, right? Back in the day. So the first camera I had, I was, I don't know, like 13 or 14, and it was a little tiny box camera. It was called a Brownie camera, I think. And it was just a box. It looked like the first camera that was invented by Edward and Land, you know, in 1889 or something. I don't know. So this camera is just a plain old box, and you held it in your hand, and there was a red button. You pushed it. What you did was you held it in your hand at stomach level, or, you know, near the bottom of your chest, and you look down into the glass. That's how you did it. And so, of course, you couldn't do very accurate pictures. No art pictures coming from this. It was all snapshots, right? My father had a camera. Now, there were good cameras at that point. My father had a camera which he got when he was traveling in Germany, working as a chemical engineer, but not really actually working for the U.S. government and pretending he was being a chemical engineer. When he was traveling in East Germany, he bought a Leica, a very, very, very beautiful, perfect old German camera from before World War II. It's a 1938 vintage camera, and it was really something, but I had no idea how to work it. And he wasn't around, so it just sat in a box. So we had brownies, and then other people had, like, there was nobody in my neighborhood, which was lower middle class. You know, nobody, their camera was a real luxury, a real camera. Somebody had their brownies. But then when I got older, I forget when this was it the 50s or 60s, that the, I think it was in the 60s or late 50s, that the Kodak cameras came out, you know, the one that, what was it called? The one that when you take a picture and it comes out, it actually has a little laboratory in it, and the it was fantastic. It was the coolest thing in the world. You take a picture, and the Kodak, what was it called? Oh, the Polaroid. How could I forget that? The Polaroid camera. My engineer right on the job. The Polaroid camera. And it was very expensive, though. And it was a big thing if a family in my neighborhood had one of these things. But it was so cool. I mean, you just snapped a picture, and it looked like an old-fashioned camera, like from way back, you know, like in the 1890s or 1900. Just you wait a little while, and out comes the picture itself, the color picture. It was definitely a miracle of the age. Anyhow, I get older, and finally I got some money in my 30s. I got some money. I bought an actual 35mm camera, a real, actual functioning camera called a Nikomat, or is it Nikormat, I forget which. And it was a fairly expensive camera. And I started taking pictures with it, and I love taking pictures. I used to take a lot of snapshots, mostly of girls and women who I was dating. That's a polite word for it. And I took many pictures that could not be circulated. You know, I was very into taking pictures of the ladies I knew. But I took pictures. I used to walk around a park, take pictures of things. But I never thought of a camera as a serious thing. And now I know, obviously, and I discovered this in my 30s, being very ignorant. And photography, you know, they taught art in college, but they never taught us about photography. Photography was not considered a major important art form, really, in general society, in this country at least, until way into the late 60s or 70s. Then it started to be recognized as a serious, sort of generally recognized as a serious art form. Of course, it was understood to be before that. But, you know, Ansel Adams and all the, you know, like Diane Arbus, all this kind of stuff. It's like really the 70s is when all that started. And people paid attention to it. There were galleries, you know, that people went and saw people's work. But it was never taken that seriously till then. And except for some, you know, there are some people I can understand. And then fashion photography, obviously that was always a big thing. And then with Avedon and other people in the late 50s and 60s, again, and in the 70s, it became an art form. But of course, there was always art to it. If you look at old photo books, you can see that the art involved some nature photography. While I was buying and selling books, I would come across, photography. The most important and the most valuable book you could find was Edwin Curtis, who did, A Vanishing Race, he called it, Photographs of the American Indians Out West. And then there was nature photography. There was this Edward Weston in the 40s and other art photographers. You may recognize these photographs. He took pictures of his absolutely beautiful girlfriend that he left his family for and ran off to live near the desert with. And he also took pictures of peppers and things. He was into curves. He loved curves and shadows. So he took pictures of dunes in the desert, his girlfriend's hip and her leg, pictures of photographs of they call them images, by the way. If you want to refer to photography as an art, you use the word images. You say this image was created, and he took pictures of peppers and absolutely great pictures, beautiful pictures, artistic, right? But and I had my camera, but the trouble was I could never, and I still have a little trouble. And I know people get very impassioned and inflamed about this, right? I had trouble because I grew up with cameras being things you take snapshots with. A camera was something that you took pictures of your kids with at their birthday or when they first started to walk or if they were funny because they, you know, got food on their face, or you took pictures of them at their graduation. A camera was something that you used for snapshots of other people. And sometimes you would take pictures, like if you went on a vacation, you know, to New Mexico or to the Caribbean or to Disney World, you take pictures of Mickey Mouse or, you know, the hotel room or the bay or the beach, you know, or the pine trees in the mountains, or a picture of you standing next to your new car, pictures of you at your wedding, graduation pictures, wedding pictures, snapshots. A camera, as far as I ever was concerned, and most people I knew, was, except those in the know, who were professional photographers, or cognoscenti. Is that a kind of spaghetti? No. Cognoscenti are people who really know things, right? They're the inner, they have inner knowledge. So the cognoscenti understood that photography was an art. But to everybody in America, it was snapshots or something that you take pictures of celebrities. You know, you would see pictures of celebrities, you know, in on the front pages of Life magazine, on the front cover of Life magazine, or in the cover. Life magazine was mostly photographs with some articles. Look magazine, Life magazine, after a look, right? And it was all photographs. And, of course, photographs were a big thing starting in the 30s and 40s when they got to be decent, although very large, portable cameras. You know, those, you see movies about reporters from the 30s or movies that take place in the 20s and 30s where they the photographer shows up with that gigantic machine, you know, with the flash bulbs, and they had to screw another one in after one went off. So, you know, photography was used for, you know, for newspapers to replace artists' drawings when they had drawings at all of, you know, of a trial or of a battle or anything. When I was buying and selling old books, one of the greatest things to get was these old Harper's magazines, Harper's Weekly or Harper's Monthly magazines from the 1870s, 80s or 90s even. Where they used, like, if they sent a war reporter to cover the Spanish-American War, or they sent somebody to cover a terrible boating accident, you know, or a tragedy on the East River or near Niagara or something like that, then they would have artist renderings because there was no photography, or they couldn't reprint photographs at that point. They couldn't reproduce them in newspapers. So a lot of these artists that they sent out, like some of them were journalists and they were also artists. You know, they would have sketches or sketches of people, celebrities or famous people in courtroom trials, whatever. And it was all drawn, right? And now they, you know, then the 20s, 30s come along, they used photography for newspapers. But basically, snapshots. When I was growing up, that's what everybody thought about photographs, snapshots. And what's the big deal? You hold the camera up, you look through, you know, the viewfinder, and you see what you want to see. You say, smile, which is probably the worst thing. It's one of those, there's a linguist, a famous American linguist named George Lakoff, who wrote a book, I think it was a couple of years ago, called Don't Think of an Elephant. Now, if I said to you, don't think of an elephant, what's the first thing you think of? An elephant, right? It's sort of some natural neurotronic perversion of you know, knee-jerk reflex of the brain, right? Especially children, if you tell children don't do that, they're going to do it. There's something almost perverse, innately perverse about most people or about the way your brain works. So remember when you had to take a picture and people would say, smile? The worst thing was graduation pictures or class pictures. You know, everybody line up and then, or here's a picture for your, here, we'll take a picture and we're going to send it to grandma. So smile. This is after they've been like, your mother or father just told you, you know, go to your room. You're going to be in your room for 3 days. Or don't you ever speak to me like that. I am your mother. Or, you know, don't you say one more word to me, you know, and I'll kick your ass or whatever. Okay. Now we're going to take a picture for your grandma. Smile. Okay, here's a picture of Joshy. He's smiling for grandma, you know. So you get that, like, you move the muscles on your face so that it lifts your lips off your teeth. It's halfway between a snarling dog and a smile for grandma, right? A smile, although, of course, some people, and, you know, if you were good at it, you could tickle a kid. You could take a picture of your kids, you could tickle them or say something funny or silly to them, then they would smile. Which is probably the secret of being a fashion photographer or, you know, a professional photographer. But here, the bottom line, yeah, I know. The bottom line is that it's for snapshots. And I never took photography seriously. And I knew people, when I was in Park Slope, I had a bookstore, old, used, and rare books. And I had a lot of money because my father and mother had died within a year of each other. And by virtue of the way they died, the amount of insurance they had or whatever, I wound up with a good amount of money. And I invested this money in certain things. Some of it was art. And I bought, you know, actual sign color prints by Chagall, or, you know, I wasn't, you know, didn't know much about art either. But once in a while, I'd buy something like fantastic stuff, or Miro, whatever. And these were supposed to be investments. And another thing I bought as investments, which I didn't really much care about at all, I like to have these prints. I had them framed, Miro, you know, Chagall, but actually sign limited prints, not stuff that was posters even, but sign limited prints for thousands of dollars. And they were beautiful, absolutely beautiful things. And I felt, you know, like that they just lit up the room. I mean, it was like this gorgeous, you know, sense of creativity just bouncing all over the place. And it's almost like there was a light inside these drawings. It was so beautiful and interesting. But I also bought photography. I bought photography as an investment. And to me, it was just merely that. It was an investment. I bought photographs and I just put them in a closet because I wasn't interested in photography. I was never really very moved or interested in photography. And the only photographs I ever liked going way back in the 70s and 80s and even for decades after that was stuff like Diane Arbus or Richard Avedon. And the pictures, close-up pictures of people's faces and all sorts of astounding postures. And, you know, or even Arbus took pictures of people whose bodies were a little deformed or odd. Did you ever see Diane Arbus's photographs? Astounding. Or Richard Avedon. They had a knack, a way, almost a genius of capturing people's faces, which brought out their real personalities. But otherwise, I've seen a million photographs and it's just a snapshot. And I would, like, for instance, now, when I go to a doctor's office, I'll look through the New Yorker magazine, and they have all the art shows that are in town, and then they have photograph shows. So they show you a prominently, you know, printed in the middle of the page will be a black and white or color photograph, and it'll say, gallery show at whatever it is, the 26th Street Gallery of, you know, John Smithers' new photography, you know. Once again, he gives us, and there's a critique, once again, he gives us a brilliant observation on the quirks and similar, blah, 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 blah. Every time I see one of these photographs, these are art photographs, right, and now photography is considered a very big art form, collectible, recognized legitimate art form. And every time I look at these photographs, or I've been to photography galleries, they still look like snapshots to me. 99% of what's considered art photography looks like plain old snapshots to me. I just have trouble, and I always did, taking most photography seriously as a way to capture the reality of the moment when you are someplace or you want to take a picture of somebody or you want to capture a mood, like if it's dusk somewhere and you want to capture what it feels like, you might use your camera. Or you go to an absolutely beautiful place and, you know, obviously the ability to take good photographs and to make it easier for everybody to take good photographs and to reproduce them has improved astoundingly in the last 10 and 20 years. And it keeps improving all the time. But, for what is still the main reason that people use their... I mean, I walk through New York City all the time. I walk around all over the place with my camera taking pictures. This is what I do now, because about a year and a half ago, I got a real camera, not a point-and-shoot, which is bizarre to me. I never understood point-and-shoot cameras. You have to hold it up about a foot away from you and point it at something. How could you possibly think about what you're looking at or frame it correctly? I mean, I never saw a point-and-shoot photo, hardly ever, that made any artistic sense to me. It's a snapshot. It's for memories. You take a picture. I walk around Manhattan all the time. There are, of course, tens of thousands of tourists at any given time walking around Manhattan day and night, constantly taking pictures of the Empire State Building, of psychotic grifters dressed up as mice or ducks in Times Square, or whatever that's, you know, classically New York, or a picture of a Broadway theater or Times Square or whatever it is, or some odd looking person, a bum on the street. Ooh, we can show this to everybody back in Jamesville. It's a bum. Let's take a picture of him. Don't get too close. You know, so people take pictures, and there are all people taking pictures all over the place. Snap, 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 snap. And I don't take point-and-shoot cameras seriously. My wife got a point-and-shoot camera. One of her relatives with some money gave her a point-and-shoot camera a couple of years ago. And she's very good at directions, though. She read it. She knows how to use it. But she loaned it to me once because I was feeling sort of nostalgic for taking pictures. Cause about 15 years ago, I had an actual camera. I had, what the hell was it? I think it was, I don't remember. I don't remember the brand anymore. But it was a decent 35-millimeter camera. And I did take pictures with it. And some of them were pretty interesting, right? You know, take different angles of the bridge spans and the way flowers look, if they were arranged a certain way. I tried to take artistic photographs, not just snapshots. And I did take snapshots, too, like I said, of my girlfriends mostly. But I liked this camera, and I used it a lot. And this is back in the day when it was more exciting in one way, that when you took pictures, you had a roll of 20 or, now I don't even remember anymore, was it 30 or 35 pictures or something like that? And you could buy 20 or 35 pictures. So you take a roll of film and you thread it into the camera, and then you close the back, and you snap the pictures or take the pictures or set up the frame the images, and then you brought it in, right? Just boys and girls, this is what we used to do. You brought it in, remember, to the camera store or to a place that developed pictures. Either it was a place that was devoted to selling cameras or fixing cameras or developing pictures or had picture frames, or it was the drugstore or wherever, right? You bring it in, you bring in the roll, you hand it to somebody. I mean, you wind it back. When you're done taking the pictures, you wind the film back inside the camera where it's dark so it doesn't get exposed and ruined. And you bring it in, and then a couple of days later, you go pick it up. And it's exciting because there's waiting, there's tension. What will it look like? Did I really get a good picture? And, of course, a few days have gone by from the wedding, the vacation, the little photo shoot that you were taking, you know, just for out of interest's sake. And you want to get the pictures back. And people say, you know, did you get the pictures? Did you get the pictures? And, of course, if you have poor impulse control or none, like me, you know how it is. You got the pictures, and as soon as you got them, before you could even walk out of the store, well, you know, they're your pictures. They could be private, and God knows what you were taking pictures of. I don't want to, you know, I know some of you are just filthy people. Who knows what you were taking pictures of? But you want a little privacy, right? And then, you know, these are pictures of, you know, like the wedding or pictures of whatever, your vacation. So you wait until you get, but people, as soon as they clear the door of the drugstore or the camera store, they would open up the pictures and look through them on the street, right? And you always see people walking on the street with smiles on their faces or with these kind of, you know, sentimental looks on their faces, and they're staring at their pictures. But no more, of course. Now there's no waiting. There's no tension. Everything happens instantaneously. The second you take a picture, you can send it all over the world, and everybody in the world can see it. The second, you know, the split second after you take a picture, it is a picture. It's there for you to look at over and over again. It is, and you can frame it any way you want. Instagram, is it? And, you know, transfer it, send it, all within seconds or a couple of minutes. It's all done. And there's something to that, and I can't exactly put it into words, right? But there's some loss involved there. It was a pain in the ass and irritating to take all these pictures at a party or a wedding or who knows what, a funeral or when people get together or of just some terrifically emotional situation involving other people that you know, friends, family, or a vacation that you had that was so beautiful or some fascinating thing that you saw. And there was something about the tension of waiting and waiting and waiting. And what built up in those few days between when you took the pictures, then when you dropped them off at the camera store or the drugstore, and then more waiting until you picked them up. And then you open up this envelope and there were your pictures, you know, 3x5s, 5x7s, whatever they were, color or black and white. And it built the tension in the waiting, built up a certain kind of excitement and added depth and value, it seemed to me, to the whole experience and to the pictures themselves. The pictures became, I don't know what's the word, the pictures became more valuable. They became more solid. They developed a kind of a life of their own because of the waiting in between. Now when you take the pictures, and also the most of the cameras that we had back in the day, you take a picture, snap, click, whatever it was, then, you have to refocus and take another picture. Now, of course, even a simple camera like the one I have, it's not simple, but a regular camera. I have a Canon, 500 or something, a Rebel. I don't remember. That's all I remember. But it's a real camera, right? And you can do all kinds of things with it. And, you can take pictures, click, 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 like press photographer, It's like there's motors on cameras, and you could just take 50 pictures in a couple of seconds. And, you don't have to, you can capture accidental or more interesting images that way, but you don't have, because you don't have to stand around and focus and wait for the light to be right and everything like that. You just keep taking pictures, and one of them will turn out to be right. But there was something about the waiting and the buildup, and, for instance, nobody waits for anything anymore. Nobody understands what it means to have to wait, to have an interim of time between when you think something and when you say it to someone else. Used to be, of course, that if somebody lived at a distance, you would write them a letter. And it would take, depending on when and where it was, anywhere from weeks to months even, way back then, or, at least a couple of days. If you lived inside a city, people who had enough money would use messengers. You could write a note to somebody, and somebody would just run, 50 blocks or, whatever, or hop on a carriage or a bus and deliver it and then come back to you. So people would write notes back and forth to each other from different parts of the city. This is before telephones. But later on, you want to talk to somebody who's in another town, another state, another country. You had to write a letter. Then later on, telephones, And so as you see all this technology, things got more and more and have become, and up until this minute, I suppose it could even be improved more, if improved is the word, things are more immediate now than they have ever been before. They're absolutely immediate. Now, for somebody like me, like I say, who thinks so rapidly and comprehends things so rapidly, in fact, much too rapidly sometimes, so I don't get a chance to really filter information correctly, either going out or coming in and get misimpressions or give misimpressions. But my brain works pretty quick, and obviously my mouth works too quick, or pretty quick anyhow. And I think everything I do quickly and too quickly. If I reach for something, I reach for it pretty quickly. If I, if I want to get rid of something, I flip it real quick. Everything I do, my whole motor system is, it turned up to high, and I don't think I know how to turn it down. Just getting older has put some limitations on it, which is good in a way. But, so I'm sort of naturally adapted to the modern technology in a way that maybe some other people aren't. It doesn't bother me that things happen so rapidly, but now it's finally gotten to the point where it bothers me, not because of a sensory overload, which there is too much of these days, but what bothers me about it is that there is no interim whatsoever for reflection or consideration. And I don't mean that like being considerate or kind to other people, although that's part of it. I mean just to consider what just happened. You could take 50 pictures in somebody's living room or walking down the street or at an event, walk to save whoever patients, whatever it is. You could take, or at a sports event or whatever, or take pictures of yourself and your buddies when you're in Afghanistan, shooting people for no good reason. Whatever you want, take a picture. And instantly, everybody can see it everywhere, And you can reproduce it, or you have your home printer. You could print it out yourself, and then you get a beautiful, like 8.5 by 11 or a poster size if you have a big enough printer to do that. God knows. So everything happens immediately. Somebody texts you, you text them right back. Somebody calls you, you instantly get the call, and you instant messaging, instant. Now, faster. New, improved, fast, quick, now. Happening now, right now. It's happening right now as we're sitting here. Jump up. Do it. My son is over last night. He's 28, right? Brilliant kid. Just graduated from law school. And But he's got his goddamn smartphone in his pocket, and we're trying to watch this TV show, which we both like a lot, a British spy show. And we're watching this thing, and even during the show, not just this is not commercials, right? It's on like Netflix, so it's just the show itself, right? So while the show is on, the thing is humming in his pocket, you know. He turns the ringer off. He knows that much because he knows I'll just grab it from him and hide it if he doesn't do that. But, you know, it's you know, he's every second he's looking at this thing. He wants it. He has to know because he's part of a generation. You know, I mean, he's a really good-hearted, really smart kid who is capable of tremendous concentration. After all, he, you know, graduated from law school with honors. I'm boasting them. And just got a really nice job somewhere, you know, as a public defender, actually. And so he knows how to concentrate. He knows how to think about things in a linear way. And he knows how to take his time to focus in. And yet he's still part of this whole new generation. And I, you know, you must recognize this, and I'm part of it, too, is that I now am addicted the same way everybody else is. I'm home most of the time. Because I don't have a regular job. I have these radio shows I do, and that's about it. I used to buy and sell old books. Again, my own employer. I was self-employed. But I've stopped doing that for various reasons, because nobody really cares about it much anymore, to buy or even read an old book or to collect them. And the other thing I was doing was book abridging. I would get these massive new books or, you know, big new books, and I would have to cut them by half or to cut a third or, you know, a quarter out of the book and still have it make sense. So it would be read as an audio book. That's a job I had. It was a very difficult job. Not everybody could do that job. You had a really tremendous memory to do that job because, like, for instance, if you got a mystery book and on page 22, somebody said that they had just bought a used sports car and it had been involved in the scene of a crime where somebody threw away a crumpled pack of cigarettes in the forest at a certain time. Then 100 pages later, that turns out to be the major clue. You had to remember that while you were cutting things out. You had to, it's always like, balancing 50 different things in the air at one time. You always had to remember where everything was so that when you cut things out, it had to make sense still to the reader, especially the worst ones were novels or mystery books where, you know, something that somebody said early in the book or some little action that somebody took was essential to something that happened later on. Anyhow, so I had all these. Now I spend most of my time at home. I read a lot. I read books. I read articles for my radio shows. I spend like 20, 30 hours a week doing research and thinking about the various radio material that I do. And then I write a blog, and I write sometimes long messages to my email list. And now, also, I post pictures, and I write messages, little captions to the pictures, and I post them. Then I'm taking pictures now a lot with this real camera I have, not a point-and-shoot. But you know, I don't, but I find myself at home, of course, the computer is always on because I get something like 70 or 80 emails a day. This is because I'm on a publicity list, so I get something like 20 PR emails a day. And they don't pay, PR people, they don't care who you are or what you're doing. If they have you on a radio list, so I get a typical PR message I might get during the day is runway, you know, like a, you know, runway finals, Miss Potato is going to be announced, or looking for that perfect eyeliner. What are you going to get for the kid? What Halloween costume are you getting? This, you know, all this crap, this gigantic pile of American cultural refuse gets poured into the email system all the time, right? So I get all this stuff, and usually I just delete it. Once in a while I get pissed off, and I'll write back, and I'll say, dear Tricia, you know, from so-and-so communications, I have a show that I do on politics, and I talk about poverty, I talk about hunger, I talk about war, I talk about, elections, I talk about things that the Justice Department is doing, I talk about pollution and the environment. Why are you sending me an announcement that the best chef in New Orleans is in town on Tuesday and I can come down and interview her? Who gives, who cares? I said, take me off your goddamn list. That's if I'm in a bad mood, which doesn't happen that often, maybe once an hour, You know, that's not that much. But anyhow, I'm home a lot, and I find myself inevitably going over, and I know that a lot of you are this way too, because I see people who are around my age, and I know they are because I've had dialogues with them on the email, who never shut up. There are people who send out emails about important issues. This happens a lot with politics too, left-wing, right-wing politics. There's one guy I know who sends out an email about every hour announcing some astounding event or some awful thing that happened or some outrage or some speech somebody made or an incredible article. And this is what happens when you get older. If you're retired, and a lot of these people I know who are retired or older or spend time at home because they have some problem going out, like emotionally or even physically, they're on the goddamn email all the time. They're always sending you communications and emails, right? And I do the same thing myself. Now, some people I don't mind hearing from all the time. I like it because some people, you know, they get in touch with you like once a day, maybe twice a day, and they will send you interesting songs that they know you might like, or they'll send you, you know, they'll send you commentary on something. Like if I do a radio show, somebody will send me some interesting commentary. They'll suggest a book or something. I like getting emails like that. But other people are just constantly bombarding you with things. But here's the point of what I'm saying. You get addicted to this instantaneousness. So I'm always going over to the damn machine. It sits there in the living room, and it's like taking over my life. Especially, like I say, because I'm home all the time. I don't, you know, if I'm at a job, I'm sure at the job you have to use a computer for everything now these days too. Unless you have a physical job, like you're a truck driver or whatever, or, you know, if you're out driving around, you know, doing something in the community, whatever. But here I am, and I'm always going over to the thing. Who, did somebody send me an email? Did I get some new information? And what am I looking for? Approval? Applause? Personal communication? There's something every second that's going to happen. It's going to show up on my email, or there's going to be an alert, or some new thing happened, you know? And you know how it is on the internet? It says, you know, when you look at something, it says 5 minutes ago, or 1 minute ago, or 30 seconds ago. Oh, okay. So there is a, it's like being addicted. It's like a cocaine thing, right? You're constantly, time is speeded up. Anything that happened like a little while ago, that hasn't been resolved is irritating and boring now. It's ancient history. Anyhow, so I'm addicted to this. Meanwhile, what was I doing? I was talking about cameras. So I never took photography seriously, and I still have trouble taking it seriously. But now, of course, I've got a camera, and I've gotten into, because I spend too much time in my apartment, I've gotten into going outside. The camera is a great way to go outside. I plan safaris. I plan photography safaris for myself. I find, I look at the Manhattan or the Bronx or Brooklyn or whatever, and I look at neighborhoods where I think there's likely to be interesting shots that I could take. Most of them are in Manhattan. And I will go out for like 2 or 3 hours and walk all over the place, walk for miles sometimes, taking photographs of anything I see that's interesting. Usually strange, displays in store windows. I take pictures of graffiti a lot. I love taking pictures of graffiti, which I consider to be the people's art, street art, outlaw art, really interesting, fascinating stuff. Some of it's just scrawls, but some of it is really incredibly balanced and beautifully done. And then a lot of times people write graffiti on top of graffiti. Then people will put up flyers or posters on a wall or on, you know, a board that's been put up at a construction site that isn't being used, right? And, you know, it'll be somebody will scroll their name and somebody else will put a poster up and somebody will rip that poster off but leave part of it. And so there's this shred of a yellow poster with some black writing on it. Around it is some older graffiti. Then somebody else will scroll another color graffiti in a different direction. Somebody will put another poster up, rip that one down, so you see nothing but a picture of half of somebody's face with two eyes staring out. And sometimes if you see all these things together, they make astounding collages. Other times I'll take pictures of, and what I like taking pictures of is things that are close up. And then sometimes I'll go someplace like to a museum. There's a Cloisters Museum in New York City. That has pictures, that has stained glass and statues and stone and wood and other kinds of statues, all from the medieval times. They're all like 14th century, for real, and 15th century, 13th century gargoyles, statues of saints, beautiful stained glass tapestries. And I've been up there a few times and take pictures. And I discovered that I like to take pictures of things close up. I like to get right in something's face. I like, you know, part of it is that I don't, of course, know how to use my camera. And this is typical of me, right? I couldn't possibly read the directions on how to use this camera. I put it on automatic, and I take snapshots on this camera that can do 5,000 other things if I was to pay attention. The only thing I noticed was I bought one simple filter that somebody told me about, because a lot of the pictures I take in the sunlight were having glare ruin the pictures. So I bought a filter, which helps out. But I take snapshots, and I like to take pictures. And I don't have telescopic lens, a telephoto lens rather, and I don't have what's called a macro lens, so I can't see too wide when I'm looking through the viewfinder. The lens won't do that, and I can't see if there's something that's happened far away. I can't see it that well either, and it would be a waste of a picture. It would just be something that's far away. So I lose out on that. Eventually, if I ever get any more money in my life, which could possibly happen, I will buy a telephoto lens. But right now, because I don't have a telephoto, I like to get up close to things, but I like it anyhow. I get up close and I take pictures of the eyes of a statue or the grain of the concrete on a wall that's been painted four different colors, and then the paint has been peeling, and then somebody scrawled on it and somebody chipped something on it, or the rust of a nail dripped down. The rust sort of dripped down over a period of weeks or months onto something else that was a poster. And I take these pictures, and they're like abstract. They look like abstract. They look very much like modern abstract paintings from the 50s and 60s and 70s. These kind of Jackson Pollock or other kinds of paintings. That's what they look like. But they are actually accumulations. They're like community art. Like I say, like 12 different people scrawled it at different times or put posters up, or the walls were painted and the paint chipped or peeled and somebody tried to repaint it. So there's lots of photos like that. And sometimes I just go to places. The other day, I went to Times Square. My photo safari was Times Square the other day. And I went from the middle of Times Square, which is basically the outdoor psychotic mental asylum of the universe. It's as crazy and sick and disturbed and dangerous and vile as it ever has been. It's just not as pornographic. And it's not quite as dangerous as it used to be. Times Square about 10 years ago was cleaned up by a combination of Giuliani and Bloomberg. Times Square was cleaned up so that more tourists would be attracted to the city, because that's where the shows are, the Broadway shows. Because places like 42nd Street and all around Times Square and the Port Authority bus terminal, where people come into New York to get their lives ruined, to change their lives. And that's where all the pimps and drug addicts, thieves, muggers, complete lunatics, absolute, rotting, toes rotting off their bodies, bums lying in the street or trying to grab you for money or to eat you. I don't know what. Times Square was always like that. And it's still a little bit like that, right? But most of the prostitutes and the pornography and the drug dealing has been shifted somewhere else or basically blasted apart by the cops and by the feds and everything. So now what used to be one endless row of porn movies and, nickel bags being traded back and forth and people buying and selling knives or, muggings, all this kind of insane stuff, or prostitution taking up, what, people standing up against a wall for $10. This kind of stuff has sort of moved away from there. And it's all now Disney theaters and M&M stores and all this kind of thing. And, it's a whole different world. But still, a lot of it remains, especially if you get anywhere near a bus terminal. If you're near a major bus terminal in a major city, there is all kinds of potentials for badness, degradation. People are lost. They're lonely. They're runaways. People are taken advantage of. People are robbed. People don't know what they're doing. A lot of transients are people who don't want to make what used to be called an honest living, hang out there and figure out ways to rip people off. So this is where I was the other day. And I walk very slowly. Everybody rushes around in New York. So people are always like, I try not to get banged into because I don't want my camera to be hurt. And I walk slowly because I want to see what's there to take a picture of. So I take all kinds of pictures. I've taken something like 180 pictures that I've posted online. Actually, I've taken about 4,000 pictures. Some of them, I guess, could be called artistic. But here's the thing. As I'm walking around taking pictures of these religious statues or, fascinating architectural decorations or, of people's faces, if they let me take pictures of them, of strange things in store windows or graffiti. When I take all these pictures, I still feel like it's snapshots. If I take pictures, for instance, of somebody else's graffiti, I am not creating anything, and that's the point. I have trouble ever accepting the fact that anything that you do with a camera involves creativity. Now, I know sometimes when I say that, it drives people completely nuts, if like professional photographers or people who love photography. I have trouble taking photography seriously as an art form because, you know, unless, of course, you these days you can take a picture of something and you can alter it any way you want. I know somebody very well who takes pictures of flowers or nature scenes and takes very good pictures, right? And then uses, her software on her Macintosh to alter these pictures and to add color, to sort of smudge things, to make other things vague, and it becomes like a painting. That I see as creative. But although I've taken a lot of pictures, and by the way, if you want to see the pictures I've taken, and having said all I just said, they really are interesting pictures. Just because they're snapshots doesn't mean they aren't interesting, even fascinating. I think I take very good pictures. And most of them are what you would call artistic or interesting or strange, not just snapshots of weddings and funerals. So I have them on a place called Tumblr. Tumblr is a place like Facebook, only it's not as stupid as Facebook, where you can post photos, videos, even texts, other things, music. And if you want to see the pictures I've taken, go to my website. It's faderfiles.com, FederFiles.com, faderfiles.com. And you just look on the homepage and you'll see a place to click on. You can go see my photo gallery. And I add pictures like every day or two to this place. But to me, and no matter what I do, and no matter how interesting or fascinating some of these pictures are, and I think some of them are extremely good. They're the kind of pictures you could probably, have a good time going to a gallery if somebody hung these pictures up that I took, right? Or you might want to have it on your wall or take a look at them anyhow. And, and I write captions, sort of artistic captions that go with them or ironic ones or whatever. But they're still photographs. They're still snapshots. I am just taking pictures of a statue or a building or graffiti or a human being, all of which were created by someone else some other time. I did not make these scrolls on the building. I did not grow this pepper in nature. I did not, create this strange old lady with feathers in her hat. She bought the hat. She is who she is. She was born. Her parents gave birth to her. I didn't have anything to do with making her or her hat. If I take a picture of some guitar player in Times Square, or if I take a picture in Times Square underneath, underground, they have this beautiful ceramic tile mosaics. Incredible stuff. Just really beautiful artwork. Real artwork that some real artist did. Created it. The colors, put the tiles on. I take pictures of them. They're really interesting pictures, but they're not creative. I don't really feel that you can actually do something creative with a camera very much. Because basically what you're doing is looking at something that was created by somebody else or that was created in nature, and you're just snapping a picture of it. No matter how you frame it, and I'm good at framing things. I have a good eye for what's interesting, right? No matter how you frame it, and how far back or how close up you get, no matter what angle you put it at, no matter whatever setting it is so that it's lighter or darker, it's still something that you're snapping a picture of. I don't feel the creativity of it, but I love doing it because it gets me out of my apartment where I spend too much time anyhow. And I talk to everybody. I mean, I will talk to anybody on the street about anything. And people talk to me. They see you taking a picture. They say, that's a nice camera. Either they want to steal it if you're in Times Square. Some guy came over to me the other day in Times Square. This guy's like a real grifter-drifter type, right? He's outside of a single-room occupancy hotel. And he says, nice camera. And I said, yeah, it's not a camera you're ever going to have. The guy I backed off. This is from my old days as a probation officer. There's some people you don't want to get that close to you, right? And some people come over, nice camera, you let them look at it, right? They can pick it up and hold it because they look like regular human beings who aren't going to run off with it. Yeah, I talk to everybody. So I have a great time taking pictures because that's my way of socializing. And then I get out and I frame things and I walk around the street looking at things. And later on, I make notes and go back and take pictures of them. So it's, for me, it's a great thing socially and even artistically. But I don't feel like it's real creativity. I love doing it. And, you know, go take a look at these pictures. But if you want to argue with me, you can always go to faderfiles.com and send me an email and tell me that I'm stupid and... you know, that I'm, you know, middle class and bourgeois and I don't understand art. It's okay. I have this all the time. People tell me that all the time. All right. I'll be around this Thursday at 2 p.m. for our political show, Occupied Territory. No, wait a minute. I won't be this Thursday. I think I'm going to do a repeat show, but I picked out a really good one. And I'll be back live next week. And I'll be here next Monday for this show. Thanks. You don't